Welcome, everybody, to episode 253 of the Metabolist 2 podcast, which features myself, Ben.
And I am David, and today we're going to talk about the Celestial Toymaker animation.
Dun, dun, dun. Yes, we are.
Which is, second recent Hartnell animation, because we did have the 10th Planet and Reign of Terror before that.
Right.
Joining recently Galaxy 4.
Yes, exactly. Which makes me realize a lot of this animation relies on things that they've already done, so they can just drop in the Troutons and have them move around and, you know, job done, basically. And I guess they could have done this with... They could have dropped in the Galaxy 4 animations into this, couldn't they?
They had Steven Taylor and they had the Doctor.
Yeah.
They just have to whip up a Dodo, a Jackie Lane.
Whip up a Jackie Lane. Are we thinking that maybe this animation had something to do with the Toymaker's return? That there might have been a bit more money spent on it?
I'm guessing since Russell Minton, who's what, the poobah of the Blu-ray range of the Doctor Who collection, and probably... It lended itself well. So stepping away from that question for briefly.
Sure. Yeah.
This
Absolutely.
Is 3D animation. And then this is the second that we've had 3D animated
right.
in the style. Or it's the same team that did the Web of Fear episode 3.
Right. And, the controversial Web of Fear episode 3.
Right. And so I think with the Toymaker coming back and the giggle, Minton and Davis, you know, RTD probably thought this would be a good one to commission, because the commissioning did seem to come out of nowhere.
It did.
And by doing the non-traditional 3D type animation, they were able to basically tell visually a different story than what we would have seen way back when this was broadcast.
It's very different, yes.
1966,
the year of my birth. Spoiler alert. definitely. I mean, so in the spirit of full disclosure, I liked that Web of Fear animation.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was an interesting experiment. I thought it was worth doing. I'd been frustrated by the kind of Scooby-Doo, Hanna-Barbera style of animating that we've been kind of getting used to with the Troughton animations. And I am all for them trying something newish.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been able to watch this on beautiful Blu-ray, and I think you have been able to watch it as well. I watched the full color, full screen version.
As did I.
But I also watched the episode 4 as well.
Oh, the surviving, the extant episode.
Yeah. The surviving black and white, just because I could. just to provide a little bit of contrast. But, where do you want to start with this?
Well, so let's talk about the animation style. This is a departure from the Scooby-Doo, the rubber arms that Gary Russell seems to have favored with the Indian animation team. This is 3D models in a 3D landscape. And
motion capture as well, I saw on the credits.
With a bit of motion capture, too. So
right.
In some ways, I think this was a vast improvement over what was done with Web of Fear, both in fluidity of animation and just camera angles. I think it improved upon what they did upon Web of Fear.
Yeah, I mean,
it also came short in some aspects, too.
Where I am with this, and again, I mean, I don't think we're really going to talk about the story. I mean, I'll have to say, since that Celestial Toymaker is not a story I revisit on a regular basis. It's weird, and it's weirder without any pictures.
Mm-hmm.
The more you pay attention to it, the less it makes sense. And actually, interestingly, I mean, just watching it again, as literally have done in the past week, it's like, oh, hang on. It's all those people complaining about how, the new Toymaker didn't really make a lot of sense for the 14th Doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Toymaker doesn't make a lot of sense. He never has done. And the games, inverted commas, that he sets people to play are nonsensical in many ways. Anyway, so that's just a by-the-by. So, again, it's not a story I watch, I engage with on a regular basis. Obviously, the Toymaker is quite a big figure in certain aspects of fandom. I think the story made a very strong impression on a lot of people when it was first shown back in 1966. We have the Toymaker maybe returning in the 1980s. He's featured in the comic strip. He's been in novels, etc., 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 etc.
Yeah, just to touch upon that, it was Jeremy Bentham, basically, who wrote the synopsis in Peter Hanning's Doctor Who: A Celebration, which came out in the 20th anniversary year.
Right.
And this is how he
remembered it,
encapsulated it.
Right.
Now, few drama productions on television have ever achieved the unique atmosphere present in four episodes of The Celestial Toymaker. You know, he goes in, the plot is quite simple, blah, blah, blah. But he concludes saying the success of the story lies in the way it visualizes a child's nightmare, the secret world of toys from the nursery come to life, harmless games that insidiously graduate into something far more sinister, smiling, happy faces concealing deadly menace. And I think this version of the animation captures more of what probably viewers, young viewers in 1966 thought they remembered than what actually appeared on the screen.
Very true. I mean, I think a lot of the early, a lot of the received wisdom that you and I received as wisdom from people in things like those program guides were written by people who were kids when they watched these shows, and they thought they were, it was amazing and awesome and super scary,
right.
Because they were kids.
Right.
And I think this is the challenge that Who has in every generation, is that every generation goes like, blimey, that was scary, because they're 6 years old. And of course it's scary. And I mean, I think in some ways we're getting, you know, the kind of some of the kickback against RTD2 is, you know, is from the 2005 generation who are watching it when they were 6 years old and like, blimey, this is scary. And now that he's back and it's 2024, it's not so scary anymore because they're a lot older.
Right.
So there is a lot of that, I think. I think that's a commonplace thread that runs through all of Doctor Who, is the ones that we saw when we were kids were the best ones.
Right.
And I can, you know, only you and I have talked about this. Obviously, we're biased. But it's clear that the Hinchcliffe years were the best ones. Whatever.
Well,
anyway,
also Letts and Dicks were also excellent years, too. I mean,
exactly.
It's basically that period where you first watched Doctor Who, that you fell in love with the program, that is going to be for almost 90-95% of Doctor Who fandom, that's going to be your sweet spot, golden years.
That's going to be spot. Exactly. So, obviously, when we watch episode 4, the surviving episode of Celestial Toy Room, I guess when we listen to the audio, but the audio is like, hang on, what's going on? Even though, you know, Peter Purves does an excellent job in the narration, you know, it's not that scary. It's certainly weird. But it's not that weird. It's not like Avengers weird or The Prisoner weird.
Yeah.
It's slightly weird, and the games really don't make a huge amount of sense. I think even to a child, you're going like, whoa, okay, floor is lava. I guess that's the game.
Yeah.
Hopscotch, if the floor is lava. So I think in some ways, this animation is a great success because it puts us into a nightmarish world of crazy angles and, you know, the toy maker is big, the toy maker is small, things fly around, we spin around things. It's very, very fluid. And we can probably talk about this. I mean, I think they could have pushed the nightmarish aspect of this slightly more since, you know, I mean, again, I think it's ironic with Celestial Toymaker, we don't have any telesnaps for the four episodes, but we do have a lot of color photographs, which is kind of weird.
Yeah, some very beautiful set photos.
Really, really gorgeous set photos. So again, I mean, we don't know a lot about camera angles and how things were shot. So there's potentially a lot of leeway to really kind of jazz this one up. To me, if a lot of it felt like a cutscene from a video game. Now I say that like it's as if it's something I know about, which of course it isn't, because I don't really play video games. But you know, I've seen cutscenes from you know, video games. So I felt that aspect was very successful.
I think where it worked really well was upping the peril for some pretty sedate, boring games,
perilous situations. Yep. Sorry.
I would imagine these games would seem, and the toys would seem dated even to a 1966 audience, children's audience. These obviously, I think, are Brian Hale's childhood with playing cards and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, as we pointed out before.
Yeah, this is a common theme that we say, you know, in Bob Holmes is often the stuff that he makes scary is the stuff that he grew up with, you know, the Fu Manchu, et cetera.
Exactly. Yeah.
Where I think the animated characters for Jackie Lane, Dodo, I thought was a pretty good likeness, captured her essence pretty well. Once I got used to Peter Purvis looking like something out of an Asterix comic, I thought, you know, he looked very Roman to me. But it's a cartoon version of Peter Purvis. And yeah, it does look like Steven Taylor sort of back in the mid-60s. The Hartnell character didn't seem to fit within the other two Time Team, TARDIS Team characters. He had kind of like Disney princess eyes, and his head seemed overly large, and it just
his legs didn't bend in the right kind of way either. I was wondering whether he was like we'll do Hartnell first, and then they learned, and I guess they didn't go back and do him again. I agree. He seemed kind of out of place. If you compared his head to Steven Taylor's head, Steven Taylor's got a giant head. Or he's got a normal size head, and the Hartnell character's got a tiny head. That didn't really mesh to me that well. Mm-hmm. I guess he's not in it very much, because it's a very Dr. Light episode, if we're going to point fingers at things being Dr. Light. I don't think Dr. Light is a new innovation. This barely had Bill Hartnell in it at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then Michael Koch as the toy maker, his animation I thought was very good. Where I think I felt disappointed mostly with the animation, aside from Hartnell, but like you said, Hartnell wasn't really in this very much, is I would have liked more likeness to the three primary actors who played all the toys.
Right.
And especially Carmen Silvera, who is an actress I'm very familiar with her work due to being on LOLO.
Right.
And so I would have liked to have seen how her dolls and clowns would have been portrayed. But all of the toys were heavily stylized and bore little to no resemblance to Carmen Silvera, nor to Campbell Singer, who played Joey the King of Heart and right. Sergeant Rudd, and then Peter Stevens, who played Cyril. I think due to having episode 4 survive, they did have kind of a the Billy Bunter likeness of Peter Stevens. That came close. He was stylized, but for like Mrs. Wig or Clara, and then Sergeant Rugg, there really wasn't any likeness at all. And I would have liked to see some hints or some nods to the original actors who played the roles.
So this is something, this is my main kind of beef here, is that, and I think I've said this about other animations, so I guess it's not, I'm really unsure how the editorial work, how this happens. Because if you're going to do, if you can do anything, if you're not going to bother is the wrong word, if you feel that it's not necessary to portray the actors being the toys, then why not base these toys on actual toys? The Sergeant Rudd character was like a comedy toy of a British, Napoleonic redcoat.
Toy soldier.
A toy soldier, exactly.
Yeah.
From the 1820s or whatever. So, why not find a real toy? Pick up one of the Britain's, mid-1960s Napoleonic war sets and, make him exactly like one of those. The cards, obviously, the King and Queen of Hearts. This is obviously Lewis Carroll. Brian Hales, wants to be Lewis Carroll. Sadly, he's not quite as witty. or I was going to say intelligent, but that's the wrong thing to say. He doesn't have the right kind of brain to be Lewis Carroll, but Lewis Carroll is something he wants to evoke here. Make them actual cards, like in Disney. Really, really push it. If you're not going to do the actual actors, then do something that is completely not the actors.
They deliberately didn't do real cards like in Disney because of Disney. That has already been done. So they did kind of an origami stylized three-dimensional playing cards for the King and Queen of Hearts.
Yeah.
And I thought of the designs, the one that really let me down was Mrs. Wig. And they kind of stylized her as a tea cozy as best I could tell. But she looked plastic, and it just had no resemblance at all to Carmen Silvera. So I thought that that was a misstep. And since, I guess, to pile on here, I do think this was a successful animation. I think it's more successful than some of our recent ones like Fury from the Deep and Underwater Menace due to the imagination. And it did take a story that, honestly, I think is incredibly dull and boring, at least in the audio version, and even in the surviving episode four.
It's boring, yeah.
It's really a dull story, and they made it at least visually interesting enough that I could get through it, although I did fall asleep in the episode episode two and picked it up again once I...
With the interminable chair game? Yeah, it's like...
Yes.
Just like, the, pick a chair the chairs. Already.
Yeah, exactly. And Dodo getting nearly frozen.
Anyway, yes, and then unfrozen.
So... I thought the animation worked overall pretty well. I would have liked to see better likenesses to the guest cast, the toy guest cast. But where I felt it really was kind of coming up short was in lip sync. It was really hard to see any kind of coordination between what the words were being said by the voice actors effectively and mapping to their animated form.
Oh, I'd agree with that. I mean, I stopped imagining that that was a thing that was happening after a while. It's like, okay, their mouths move. Weirdly, I would have thought that's maybe the easiest thing to do, or maybe it isn't the easiest thing to do. I literally have no idea.
Yep.
But you surely can look at the kind of sine waves of noise and match those to mouths opening, closing. I don't know. Maybe you can't.
Right.
Maybe it's super hard. But yeah, no, that didn't bother me in the end, because I just thought, okay, they aren't really bothering with it, so I'm not going to bother with it either. Again, I think your plea is that they would have pushed the toys nearer to what they were in the images that we have. My plea is they should have pushed the toys in the other direction. And
sure,
I think they landed kind of uneasily in the middle. I wrote some notes. Hartnell, I guess he wasn't a toy, but he was like really reminding me of Rick from Rick and Morty. And I know Rick from Rick and Morty is kind of modeled on Doctor Who in some ways, the Hartnell Doctor. But it's like, wow, yeah, that looks like Rick from Rick and Morty. The Silent Clown. Does the Silent Clown have a name? Can't remember.
Joey
was really frighteningly remind me of Art the Clown from the Terrifier movies, which I'm going to say you haven't seen.
No, I haven't.
Because you haven't. Know you well enough at this point. Which, again, you know, with a little bit of push, it's like, why? That could have been Art the Clown from Terrifier movies. I would have liked to have pushed Cyril, who's obviously Billy Bunter, the fat owl of the remove. Let's push him really, and let's have him be Billy Bunter. Let's really bunter him up.
Mm-hmm.
Because why wouldn't
we? Which is another character. I don't know how dated Billy Bunter was in 1966.
Oh, Billy Bunter's pretty done by 1966, yeah.
Yeah, so it's sort of like you said, in this animated version, why not just go full in if that's what you're going to do?
Just go full Bunter. I mean, Billy Bunter's from the 20s and 30s, as far as I remember. The character's out of copyright, I'm pretty certain. You know, mm-hmm. just go for it. I mean, Alan Moore's, but Billy Bunter and his stuff, you know, et cetera. Because, you know, Alan Moore...
Yep.
Grew up reading ancient comics, which is why he likes ancient comics so much. So, yeah, I mean, I think that would have helped. And one thing that popped into my head, and this is probably heretical in some ways and also probably wrong in other ways. I was thinking, okay, Michael Goff is an amazing actor. We love Michael Goff. He went out with Annika Wills. He was in Batman. You know, he's in a whole bunch of things, and he was a well-known kind of crazy guy that did a lot of great stuff. I know we're concerned that this story is called The Celestial Toymaker, and I know we're concerned that the Toymaker, played by Michael Goff, wears the robes of a stage Chinaman from, you know, the music hall. We're now looking at Robert Holmes again, and we're thinking about mm-hmm. Fu Manchu, and, you know, we're thinking about Sexton Blake, and we're thinking about Yellow Menace, blah, 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 in inverted commas. It could have been possible to make the Toymaker character Chinese. I mean, it absolutely could have been possible. Goff's urbane baritone is raceless, as far as I understand voices to be. You could have pushed it all the way back. And I mean, I can see why they didn't. And I've said this in all of the animations we've reviewed. I would have liked someone in editorial, or you know, in product, in the, you know, the producer level, to go like, okay, let's just go for it. Let's just make this something completely different, rather than what I feel from time to time is a kind of an uneasy trying to please everybody by, oh, fans who remember it from 1966. You know, look, yes, it's Steven Taylor. And fans from 2015 are going to go like, who the hell's Steven Taylor? Anyway, so I don't know. That was just something that popped into my head as maybe we could just... Because, I mean, you know, the animation, you know, all the kind of computerized whizzing around. And there was one, sorry, really distracting bit in episode 4 when the TARDIS team are back in the TARDIS. And we have a shot which is sort of through the time rotor.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this kind of super accurate reflection of everybody in the glass of the top of the time rotor, which is like, wow, that is obviously so easy to do by pushing a button on a computer to get like a super accurate reflection. They've just done that, but it actually ends up being really, really distracting. And just because you can do easy stuff like that, you shouldn't. And, you know, if it's going to be a nightmarish foray into the realm of fantasy, let's make it a nightmarish foray into the realm of fantasy.
Yeah, I think the reason why you couldn't push it with Celestial Toymaker beyond where they did is, of the guest cast, Michael Gough is a well-known actor.
Yes.
I mean, he's a big name in acting. He has a, you know, a cinematographic career, a televisual career.
Absolutely.
I don't think you would want to abandon the likeness of Michael Gough.
Likeness is putting a bit strongly, but yes, I see
as
what
close
you mean.
As this team was going to do.
Right.
Of the remaining stories left to animate, if you're going to push it, you have the Savages, which has very little visual representation. I believe there's telesnaps, but the prime candidate for really pushing it and making it is Space Pirates. And I know you've championed Super Marionation.
I have.
As it, but you could do a very stylized 3D cartoon or whatever we want to call these animations.
Oh, yeah.
For the Space Pirates. You wouldn't have to do it in a traditional 2D animation that we've had for rest of Troughton's Bar Web 3. So Space Pirates does seem like it would be ripe for really pushing it and going, okay, what does sci-fi look like in the late 60s?
Right.
What could they have done if they really had the budget? Let's go Barbarella direction or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they have, you know, there's these amazing Yves Saint Laurent style 60s modernist dresses, you know, have those be swirling around. The spaceships could be zooming about, you know. It's, yeah, I absolutely, I think this style would really fit that style of story. And, you know, because Super Marionation has the same, you can do camera angles.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why Gerry Anderson did Super Marionation is because he couldn't raise the money to make live action shows.
Right.
So always Gerry Anderson was like, okay, this is live action. It's puppets, but it's live action.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, absolutely appropriate. So yes, I would agree with you. I would accept that as the animation for the Space Pirates. Thinking about that, I haven't watched many of them, but I mean, I'm thinking about the Adam and Joe show and how they kicked off very, very crude animation using Star Wars figures, and how that then was, you know, in some ways ripped off by Adult Swim here in the States. And you have, you know, you have these animation using action figures, and it's just the mouths that move with, you know, little bits of paper. Very, very kind of primitive stuff.
Right.
As everyone knows who listens to this podcast, I'm a big fan of the character range of action figures. Which are brilliant. The likenesses are fantastic. I'm not saying, well, why aren't they making this with action figures? Because they could. But at the very least, why are we not just using the scan that they use from the character used to make Bill Hartnell as the first Doctor? Why is that computerized scan just not being utilized for the likeness, for instance, in this reconstruction?
So a better likeness of Hartnell.
A better likeness. I mean, not an actual likeness of Hartnell.
Mm-hmm.
If you pick up, you know, the most recent release from Character Options of the First Doctor and the Sensorites, you're holding Bill Hartnell in your hand. It looks exactly like him.
Hmm.
So it is possible to kind of model this in three dimensions because that's what an action figure is.
Yeah.
It is possible to model this in three dimensions. And again, you know, I obviously I have no idea how any of this works contractually and, you know, how all this fits together. But, you know, that was something that kind of popped into my head, is that if we're going to do super marination is an idea, if the action figures are so good, if this computer animation, you know, it allows us to have the camera angles that we're just not getting with the Scooby-Doo animation, maybe there should be some kind of crossover. But who knows? I know nothing about these things.
So to compare this to the Scooby-Doo animation, which the sets seemed overly large for 1960s Doctor Who, with this retelling of Celestial Toymaker, visual retelling, the big expansive sets work.
Yes.
Because you have lots of visual things going on, and the 16 by 9 lends itself to this freaky... Unfortunately, it wasn't psychedelic. I would have liked to push it in that kind of direction, that maybe lean in a little more into maybe Brian Hales was dropping acid when he wrote this type of thing, you know?
I was thinking about the Time Monster and the great big eyes mm-hmm. that appear behind Joe and the Doctor and the various TARDISes, and it's all blue screen stuff. And, mm-hmm. you know, that is properly psychedelic. Mm-hmm. And I think, again... I was waiting for that to happen. I was waiting for the... They had an evocation of some lava lamps, and obviously lava lamps are a key element of 60s Doctor Who's. The Daleks are very fond of them as part of their spaceships and general kind of control systems.
Mm-hmm.
I was waiting for it to go full lava lamp, and mm-hmm. it never did. And that was a bit disappointing.
They did have lava lamps in some places, and they did do, like, the... with the toy maker being larger, projecting, you see his eyes or his mouth and stuff, but they didn't... Like you said earlier, they didn't push it far enough to do it. They had the hints of it, and they just... The weirdest they got was in part one with the Chutes and Ladders game, where it's a non, you know, it's more Escher.
Escher style. What I was kind of looking for, I mean, I don't know whether you had this in America, but when you went to the cinema in the 70s as a kid, to go and see, you know, The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad or The Journey to the Center of the Earth. Before, as everyone knows, certainly in those days, it was exciting to go to the cinema in general, but in particular because there were commercials beforehand, so like actual, you know, adverts for things. But when there weren't trailers and when there were adverts, when you'd gone in early, they had used to have these big swirly oil projections. Did you have those in America before movies? Like super swirly, kind of colored clouds of like mixing in with each other.
Yeah, it sounds vaguely familiar.
Yeah, I was wanting that. I was wanting a lot more of that. I was wanting things to suddenly switch into black and white, or like it to be Top of the Pops, you know, and everything is the colors are pushed in the wrong direction. I was waiting for that to happen, and I think, and again, this is. Is this a criticism? It's meant not really meant as a criticism, because I know these animations have to be all things to everyone,
mm-hmm.
which I think actually probably in the end means they don't fully please anybody. But I would like someone to just take them and just run with them and make them the wildest and craziest thing you've ever seen. And I think this would have been the ideal story to do that.
There's nothing stopping fan animators from doing
animators
from doing that. With the photo reconstructions that are on these DVD Blu-ray releases, you have the soundtrack that you can then do your own animation to. And I fully expect us to see sometime before my life is over to see a re-release of some of these animations done. You know, in 20 years' time, what they can do with animation.
I don't know whether you're following the soap opera of Ian Levine's animations.
No, I haven't.
Are you following that at all?
No.
But, I mean, he's doing these AI animations using telesnaps and then a bunch of AI people who know how to do AI animation. And he's, you know, basically remaking lost stories as closely as possible, in Ian Levine speak, as the original, as he can remember them to be. And, you know, by and large, they are Uncanny Valley kind of creepy, which is fine because it's animation. You know, it's a weird kind of reductive exercise to try and reproduce them exactly as you remember them to be, because they're gone forever, and that kind of doesn't matter anymore in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess what you're saying is already happening. And, you know, Ian Levine, he says he sold his record collection. He sold all the rights to the Cheeky Girls or whoever he produced back in the day. And he's putting all his money into doing these AI reconstructions,
mm-hmm.
Which are available if you follow him on Twitter or on Facebook. And anyway, but yeah.
Well, the animation that I'm most interested in is in Gavin Rymill's project to animate the Highlanders from the telesnaps. And it might be very similar to what Levine is doing, but what Gav Rymill does is he will act out the various roles on green screen and then map the telesnap onto his acting and mix it in and separate out the background from the foreground actors. And he's getting close, at least in some of the telesnaps of the Highlander, to what actually one can imagine was broadcast when on the screen.
Yeah. And I mean, I think the difference there, I mean, I think everyone likes Gavin Rymill, Ian Levine's a little bit of a divisive character. Also, Ian Levine is very impatient, and I think some of his animations have been pushed too quickly, too far in weird directions, which don't really work that well. I think, you know, Gav's got the patience, and to be fair to Ian Levine, he's also a lot younger than Ian Levine, who's not well and is in his early 70s, to, you know, work carefully and slowly on these, and we'll see what happens. But I mean, I think you're right. I think we are going to see an explosion. Is that the right word? You know, like a flowering of fan animations of these soundtracks. And I very much hope that that isn't going to be a problem for the BBC or Disney or whoever ends up owning Doctor Who. I hope they don't sit on these and squash them. I think this is a real potential for creativity on a kind of granular level. And I think that's just good in general, where people have access to tools that can allow them to be super creative around things that they like. You know, what I've seen, you know, I see, because I work tangentially in the visual arts, you know, I see a lot of AI animation done by artists, and most of it is bollocks, because it's super reductive. It's like, why are you doing this?
Right.
What is this? This isn't telling me anything other than you can program a computer to do a thing. I think what's interesting about using these technologies to animate Doctor Who is you're doing something that already has a meaning, and it's something that you're very committed to as a fan, and has a result that is quantifiable and is not simply experimental and being experimental for the sake of being experimental.
So dialing back to Celestia Toymaker, what I would have liked to see as an improvement, I would have tightened up the soundtrack. I think there's this reliance of having it be the exact same length.
Right.
When these are really slow stories to begin with, that doesn't help anything. And yep. They did take liberties with this. They did edit out the controversial line of the King in Hearts with the Eeny, Meeny, Miny, Moe second part. They seem to have added, I think, sound effects from the Mind Robber a bit some places to kind of to tie things what visually were they were adding to the screen, but the pacing in some of the places was just dirt slow, and it could have, you know how they are doing with the cut down versions for the memory TARDIS ones. This could have cut this down.
Absolutely.
To pick up the pace a little bit to make it a little more snappy of a story.
There are these weird bits where there's like a second or two of silence.
Yeah.
And I don't actually know what's happening in that second of silence. In fact, nobody does because it's gone.
Right.
And they kind of fill it by people just not speaking and looking at each other instead. And that really kills the mood for me. If you got dead air, which was obviously some kind of business that we are literally unable to reproduce because we don't know what it is, cut it.
Right.
Just get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, it doesn't take 3 seconds for Stephen to reply to Dodo when Dodo's just said something.
Yeah.
Just cut that bit. And, you know, I'm cool with that. And again, I mean, I think this would be more in the line of me saying that I really want someone to take these animations in hand and go like, screw it. This is what we're going to do.
Mm-hmm. If you're not going to be faithful to yes. the visuals, why are you being faithful to the audio to that extent that you're keeping the dead air? I don't agree with that decision.
Yeah, if we have, especially if we have no way of ever recovering these visuals, and we don't, you know, I mean, yeah, maybe in Nigeria somewhere, whatever, but you know, I'm discounting that. You know, this is gone forever. This is like a destroyed painting. We, mm-hmm. we've got pictures of it, but it's never coming back. So let's really work with that. And if we, you know, if we're not going to be faithful to the images, because we can't, because the images no longer exist, then let's not be faithful to the soundtrack either. Obviously, you know, be faithful to it being a story and it being what it was in terms of its structure. But yeah, you know, cut out those empty bits. You know, we've already cut out a piece of language that was perfectly acceptable for whatever reason in the 1960s and is absolutely, for the best of reasons, not acceptable nowadays. Okay, let's do some other stuff that involves just kind of...
Let's at least cut out the dead air, you know?
Yeah, exactly. The very least, when, like, there's literally nothing happening. And don't replace nothing happening with also nothing happening.
Right.
You know, don't have the character stand 4-3 seconds or so.
Right.
I try to evoke that in my silence.
Which I'll have tightened it up already in the edit.
because it just seems weird. Don't do that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know.
So my other wish with this, and I do agree with you, I think this was successful for what it was trying to do, and it did make Celestial Toymaker bearable to watch. You need to do something better with facial animation, including lip sync, but also just expressiveness of actors' faces.
Yeah.
If you're having a human cast, if it's not Rills or whatever you have in Chumblies, you need to have some kind of variety. And that's where the early animations, and even like Power and the Rob Ritchie ones, the ones that he was involved with, they had more facial expressions in their animated toolbox. And with
right.
these 3D animations, the lip sync isn't good and they aren't putting a lot of motion capture into facial expressions. And you really need that, I think.
If you're going to do mocap on the figures, which I absolutely, yes, do that. Let's do it. I don't know how this works, so I'm sorry. Let's try and do this on the face as well. I guess it's more expensive, but it's like these people are moving in a pseudo natural way. But their faces are like big blobs of like modeling clay that are kind of just moving around very, very basically.
Wallace and Gromit had more facial expressions than Steven and Dodo.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. In fact, actually, I'm just looking it up. There's an actor who I've forgotten the name of, and I'm going to remember it cast. Here you go. Who played a lot of villains in movies in the 80s, a lot of 80s villains, called Robert Zarr. Look him up, Robert, Z-DAR, who had a quite serious facial deformity that made him look really scary, and therefore he played villains. That's what Steven looks like. And he has this immobile, vaguely deformed villain face that made me frightened of him, because he was always threatening to hit people and attack people, and he was, you know, he's kind of mean and dictatorial to Dodo all the way through. I was like, he's not behaving like a hero. He's behaving like a villain. The only thing that made him unvillainous was his stripy t-shirt, which luckily made me less scared of him. But anyway.
Yeah, I was glad they kept the groovy 60s wardrobe with stripy shirt and Dodo's mini skirt.
Those outfits are absolutely iconic.
Yeah.
And that's one thing where they shouldn't have made any changes, because there was no changes that needed to be made. It's perfect. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I just looked at Robert Zarr, and you're right. He does, the Steven Taylor animation really did look like it. I was thinking some of the Romans in the Asterix things with the big
also,
chin and the
yeah.
big nose, but...
Yeah, 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 yeah. It's like, I mean, I know, you know, Peter Purvis looks like Peter Purvis.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a good caricature of Peter Purvis. I think they could have done better. It was a pretty good caricature of Jackie Lane. you know, she has a young woman's face, so, you know, I think there's less features to work with in terms of caricature. Mm-hmm. And Bill Hartnell, as I said, just looked like Rick from Rick and Morty, and that really kind of... I was thankful that he was invisible for most of the time.
indeed.
And also not hearable either, both intangible and also inaudible.
Yeah, well, that speaks to the frustration that Innes Lloyd was having with his leading man back in...
Wanted to get rid of him, yeah.
16. This was the one idea to get rid of him, wheeling the toy maker every time he wanted to change the Doctor. And I'm glad we got what we did, but the toy maker could have had a lot bigger role in an ongoing Doctor Who series.
God, imagine if the toy maker had to turn up every time the Doctor... They needed to change actors mm-hmm. in Doctor Who. That'd be crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. What would happen when they needed to change the actor playing the Toymaker?
Well,
someone else would have had to turn up who's more powerful than the Toymaker, like maybe Sutek. Riding on a TARDIS.
Yep.
Like it's a rodeo bull thing in Las Vegas.
Raging bull.
Raging Sutek. Raging dog. Mad dog.
Mad dog Sutek, yep. There
Mad
we go.
Dog Sutek. I'm of the opinion that we're not finding any more of these. They're not hidden away in Cyprus or Iran or whatever. So this is what we're, if we want box sets, if we want Blu-ray box sets of each season, this is what we're going to get. And I think this was a good enough experiment to see how this works better than it worked for Web of Fear. I think I said this when we were talking about Galaxy 4. I was like, what are the decisions being made here? I don't understand them. I wish there was a... I don't want to speak ill of Gary Russell because he's kind of an amazing guy. But, you know, if there needs to be a showrunner for these animations, and it needs to be someone with the level of clout of RTD, and that showrunner needs to basically make these things be as distinctive as possible. And I think we saw some of that in Galaxy 4. It was some of the series like this and Werner Panton chairs that weren't in the original, but we're going to put these in anyway. I don't know how these decisions are being made, and I would like to be making those decisions. And if I was making the decisions, this would all be a lot weirder.
You'd push it.
I certainly would. And I think the opportunity to do this is Space Pirates. Let's go for it, lads.
There you go. Well, Space Pirates, we'll have to do a GoFundMe and and commission it.
We got our family to do all the motion capture for it.
Oh, there you go.
I'm in space. Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah.
Talk about a disaster.
Yeah, disaster in the making. Yeah. We'll empty out our 401ks and do an animation, a homemade animation of the Space Pirates.
Yep.
There you go. What a good investment that would be. Our wives would be delighted.
Well, they would be starring.
They would be starring.
In the motion capture.
Exactly, of all the women.
Well, what we got Lisa Danely as the only woman. Oh, and we also have Wendy Padbury. So
well, that's true. They have to be a fight. They have to be like a standoff between Amanda and Rita about who gets to be Wendy Padbury and who gets to be Madame Igrissi.
Oh, funny. They'll play pickleball. Yeah. It'll be a pickleball match.
It'll be a pickleball tournament to the death. Funny. All right. I think that's all I have to say about this animation, I'm afraid, man.
Yeah, I think fills the gap between the Ark and the gunfighters.
Yeah.
And so
the Doctor breaks a tooth on those sweets that Billy Bunter gives him. Bastard.
You would think the doc, yeah, I mean, he's cautioning Steven and Dodo throughout the story, which is why he gets muted, and then he doesn't listen to Dodo's advice or Steven's advice. I'm just going to eat this rock here.
I'm just going to eat. They're evil. They've been given to me by someone who's definitely evil. These candies cannot also be evil. Yeah, it's a doctor fail there, right?
Yeah, story-wise, I don't think this does the cast any favors. I think Dodo is incredibly dumb in the story, but I think she has to be in order for this to work.
Yeah, for these games, these alleged games to function. Which chair is it? I've now lost any interest in finding out which chair it is because it's gone on way too long. Let's go to the kitchen.
Yep.
Anyway, yeah.
Yeah, so... it's a serviceable animation. I think it's an improvement over the 3D animation that we had previously of Web of Fear. I would like to see, I would like to see them revisit the Web of Fear and try to touch up on some of the problems. But
I would like them to do that also.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, how much longer do we have to live? Like another 20 years or so, 20, 30 years?
2030.
There's going to be more stuff for us. Mm-hmm. All you and I have to do is to sit tight, don't die accidentally, and some more of this stuff will happen.
More stuff to podcast on.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. It's quite simple. That's our plan.
All right. Well, okay. Thank you for listening to episode 253 of the Metabolist 2 podcast. I have been wondering how far I can push this podcast with Ben.
And I've been wondering, I've always kind of said trilogic, but it's trilogic, of course, with David.
Advanced to move 632.
Yeah, or something.
253, obviously, that's the podcast.
Yes, faster move 253. I thought that looked very elegant, actually. I like that. I thought that was some good use of... I mean, like all things, you know, machines are a lot easier to animate than people. This should just be Daleks.
They could have done an extended cut of every move of the Tower of Hanoi game there for as a DVD extra.
Absolutely. Every move. I'd watch that. I think that would be fun to see. But anyway, whatever.
If they had lava lamps in the background, perfect.
Yes. Yeah, and some big eyes.
Dodo's eyes in the background.
Big Dodo eyes, exactly. Big Jackie Lane eyes.
Okay. Well, talk to you again.
Okay. Thank you very much, everyone. Goodbye. Pussy good. Actually, there was a funny thing on Twitter.
Yeah.
They've actually found a lane in Britain called Jackie Lane. It's like, well, if only Ruby Sunday's mother had been pointing to Jackie Lane.
Oh, that would have been perfect.
But oh no, she was pointing to Ruby Ridge or whatever it is. Can't remember. Ruby Sunday.
Ruby Lane.
Ruby Lane, yeah.